The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
Welcome back to the best of C.M. Cornbluth. And the story I was reading from last week, Gomez, I'll now continue with that story. We left off where he was ready to erase the board and kept complaining because he knew he was all right. He would remember it, even though he might not see it again. Julio, I said, appalled, why don't you get out of here for a while? Why don't you run over to New York and see your folks and have some fun? They can't keep you here against your will. They told me I shouldn't, he said uncertainly. And then he got tough. You're damn right, Beale. Let's go in together. I get dressed up, you tell Letzer. He couldn't quite face up to the hard-boiled security man. I told Letzer, who hit the ceiling, but it all boiled down, to was that he sincerely wished Gomez and I wouldn't leave. We weren't in the army. We weren't in jail. I got hot at last and yelled back that we were damn well going out and he couldn't stop us. He called New York on his direct wire, and apparently New York confirmed it regretfully. We got on the 405 Jersey Central with Higgins and Dalhousie tailing us at a respectful distance. Gomez didn't notice them, and I didn't tell him. He was having too much fun. He had put a shine on his shoes at Penn Station and worried about the taxi fare as we rode up to Spanish Harlem. His parents lived in a neat little three-room apartment. A lot of the furniture looked brand new, and I was pretty sure who had paid for it. The mother and father spoke only Spanish and mumbled shyly when mi amigo Beale was introduced. I had a very halting conversation with the father while the mother and Gomez rattled away happily, and she poked his ribs to point up the age-old complaint of any mother anywhere that he wasn't eating enough. The father, of course, thought the boy was a janitor or something in the Pentagon, and as near as I could make out, he was worried about his Julio being grabbed off by a man-hungry government girl. I kept reassuring him that his Julio was a good boy, a very good boy, and he seemed to get some comfort out of it. There was a little spat when his mother started to set the table. Gomez said reluctantly that we couldn't stay, that we were eating somewhere else. His mother finally dragged from him the admission that we were going to the Portobello so he could see Rosa, and everything was smiles again. The father told me that Rosa was a good girl, a very good girl. Walking down the three flights of stairs with yelling little kids playing tag around us, Gomez asked proudly, you not think they in America only a little time, hey? I yanked him around the elbow as we went down the brownstone stoop into the street. Otherwise, he would have seen our shadows, for sure. I didn't want to spoil his fun. The Portobello was full, and the pretty little girl was on duty at cashier at the table. Gomez got a last-minute attack of cold feet at the sight of her. No table, he said. We better go someplace else. I practically dragged him in. We'll get a table in a minute, I said. Julio, said the girl when she saw him. He looked sheepish. Hello, Rosa. I'm back for a while. I'm glad to see you again, she said tremulously. I'm glad to see you again, too. I nudged him. Rosa, this is my good friend Beale. We work together in Washington. Pleased to meet you, Rosa. Can you have dinner with us? I'll bet you and Julio have a lot to talk over. Well, I'll see. Look, there's a table for you. I'll see if I can get away. We sat down and she flagged down the proprietress and got away in a hurry. All three of us had arroz con pollo, rice with chicken, and lots of other things. Their shyness wore off, and I was dealt out of the conversation, but I didn't mind. They were a nice young couple. I liked the way they smiled at each other, and the things they remembered happily, movies, walks, talks. It made me feel like a benevolent uncle with one foot in the grave. It made me forget for a while the look on Gomez's face when he turned from the blackboard he had covered with two simple math. Over dessert, I broke in. By then, they were unselfconsciously holding hands. Look, I said, why don't you two go on and do the town? Julio, I'll be at the Madison Park Hotel. I scribbled the address and gave it to him, and I'll get a room for you. Have fun and reel in any time. I rapped his knee. He looked down and I slipped him 420s. I didn't know whether he had money on him or not, but anything extra the boy could use he had coming to him. Swell, he said, thanks, and looked shamefaced while I looked paternal. I had been watching a young man who was moodily eating alone in a corner, reading a paper. He was about Julio's height and build, and he wore a sports jacket pretty much like Julio's, and the street was pretty dark outside. The young man got up moodily and headed for the cashier's table. Gotta go, I said. Have fun. I went out of the restaurant right behind the young man and walked as close behind him as I dared, hoping we were being followed. After a block and a half of this, he turned on me and snarled. What are you, mister? A wolf? Beat it. Okay, I said mildly, and turned and walked the other way. Higgins and Dalhousie were standing there flat-footed and open-mouthed. They sprinted back to the Portobello, and I followed them. But Julio and Rosa had already left. Tough fellows, I said to them as they stood in the doorway. They looked as if they wanted to murder me. He won't get into any trouble, I said. He's just going out with his girl. Dalhousie made a strangled noise and told Higgins, cruise around the neighborhood, see if you can pick them up. I'll follow Vilcek. He wouldn't talk to me. I shrugged and got a cab and went to the Madison Park Hotel, a pleasantly unfashionable old place with big rooms where I stay when business brings me to New York. They had a couple of adjoining singles. I took one in my own name and the other for Gomez. I wandered around the neighborhood for a while and had a couple of beers in one of the Ulta Irish bars on 3rd Avenue after a pleasant argument with a gent who thought the Russians didn't have any atomic bombs and faked their demonstrations and that we ought to blow up their industrial cities tomorrow at dawn. I went back to the hotel. I didn't get to sleep easily. The citizen who didn't believe Russia could maul the United States pretty badly, or at all, had started me thinking again. All kinds of ugly thoughts. Dr. Mines, who had turned into a shrunken old man at the mention of applying Gomez's work, the look on the boy's face, my layman's knowledge that present-day atomic energy taps only the smallest fragment of the energy locked up in the atom. My layman's knowledge that once genius has broken a trail in science, mediocrity can follow the trail. But I slept at last for 3 hours. At 4:15 a.m., according to my watch, the telephone rang long and hard. There was some switchboard and long-distance operator mumbo-jumbo, and then Julio's gleeful voice, Bill, congratulate us. We got marriage. Married? I said fuzzily. You got married, not marriage. How's that again? We got married, me and Rosa. We get on the train. The taxi driver takes us to Justice of Peace. We got married. We go to hotel here. Congratulations, I said, waking up. Lots of congratulations. But you're underage. There's a waiting period. Not in this state, he chuckled. Here is no waiting periods, and here I have 21 years, if I say so. Well, I said, lots of congratulations, Julio. And tell Rosa she's got herself a good boy. Thanks, Bill, he said shyly. I call you so you don't worry when I don't come in tonight. I think I come in with Rosa tomorrow, so we tell her mama and my mama and papa. I call you at the hotel. I still have the piece of paper. Okay, Julio, all the best. Don't worry about a thing. I hung up chuckling and went right back to sleep. Well, sir, it happened again. I was shaken out of my sleep by the strong, skinny hand of Admiral MacDonald. It was 7:30 in a bright New York morning. Dalhousie had pulled a blank canvassing the neighborhood, for Gomez got panicky and bucked it up to higher headquarters. "Where is he?" the admiral rasped. "On his way here with his bride of one night," I said. "He slipped over a couple of state lines and got married." "By God," the admiral said, "we've got to do something about this. I'm going to have him drafted and assigned to special duty. This is the last time." "Look," I said, "you've got to stop treating him like a chess piece. You've got duty, honor, country on the brain, and thank God for that. Somebody has to. It's your profession. But you can't get it through your head that Gomez is a kid, and that you're wrecking his life by forcing him to grind out science like a machine. And I'm just a stoop of a layman. But you have professionals worried once about digging too deep and blowing up the whole shebang." He gave me a piercing look and said nothing. I dressed and had breakfast sent up. The admiral, Dalhousie, and I waited grimly until noon, and then Gomez boned up. "Come on up, Julio," I said tiredly. He breezed in with his blushing bride on his arm. The admiral rose automatically as she entered and immediately began tongue-lashing the boy. He spoke more in sorrow than in anger. He made it clear that Gomez wasn't treating his country right, that he had a great talent and it belonged to the United States, that his behavior had been irresponsible, that Gomez would have to come to heel and realize that his wishes weren't the most important thing in his life, that he could and would be drafted if there were any more such escapades. "As a starter, Mr. Gomez," the admiral snapped, "I want you to set down immediately the enfieldment matrices you have developed. I consider it almost criminal of you to arrogantly and carelessly trust to your memory alone matters of such vital importance. Here." He thrust pencil and paper at the boy, who stood drooping and disconsolate. Little Rosa was near crying. She didn't have the ghost of a notion as to what it was about. Gomez took the pencil and paper and sat down at the writing table silently. I took Rosa by the arm. She was trembling. "It's all right," I said. "They can't do a thing to him." The admiral glared briefly at me and then returned his gaze to Gomez. The boy made a couple of tentative marks. Then his eyes went wide and he clutched his hair. "Dios mío," he said. "Está perdido. Olvidado," which means, "My God, it's lost, forgotten." The admiral turned white beneath his tan. "Now, boy," he said slowly and soothingly, "I don't mean to scare you. Just relax and collect yourself. Of course you haven't forgotten, not with that memory of yours. Start with something easy. Write down a general biquadratic equation, say." Gomez just looked at him. After a long pause, he said in a strangled voice, "No puedo. I can't. I forgot. I don't think of the math or physics at all since." He looked at Rosa and turned a little red. She smiled shyly and looked at her shoes. "That is it," Gomez said hoarsely. "Not since then. Always behind in the back of my head is the math, but not since then." "My God, the Admiral said softly, can such a thing happen? He reached for the phone. He found out that such things can happen. Julio went back to Spanish Harlem and bought a piece of the Portobello with his savings. I went back to the paper and bought a car with my savings. McDonald never cleared the story, so the Sunday editor had the satisfaction of bulldozing an admiral, but didn't get his exclusive. Julio and Rosa sent me a card, eventually announcing the birth of their firstborn, a 6-pound boy, Francisco, named after Julio's father. I saved the card, and when a New York assignment came my way, it was the National Association of Dry Goods Wholesalers. Dry goods are important in our town. I dropped up to see them. Julio was a little more mature and a little more prosperous. Rosa, alas, was already putting on weight, but she was still a pretty thing and devoted to her man. The baby was a honey-skinned little wiggler. It was nice to see all of them together, happy with their lot. Julio insisted that he'd cook arroz con pollo for me, as on the night I practically threw him into Rosa's arms, but he'd have to shop for the stuff. I went along. In the corner grocery, he ordered the rice, the chicken, the garbanzos, the peppers, and swept along by the enthusiasm that hits husbands in groceries about 50 other things that he thought would be nice to have in the pantry. The creaking old grocer scribbled down the prices on a shopping bag and began painfully to add them up while Julio was telling me how well the Portobello was doing and how they were thinking of renting the adjoining store. $17.42, the grocer said at last. Julio flicked one glance at the shopping bag and the upside-down figures. Should be $17.39, he said reprovingly. Add up again. The grocer painfully added up again and said, is $17.39, sorry. He began to pack the groceries into the bag. Hey, I said. We didn't discuss it then or ever. Julio just said, don't tell Bill, and winked. One more story by this gentleman. This one is called The Adventurer by C.M. Cornbluth. President Folsom, 24, said petulantly to his Secretary of the Treasury, "Boat me to hell, Bannister, if I understand a single word of that. Why can't I buy the Nicolaides collection? And don't start with the Reed discount and the Series W business again. Just tell me why." The Secretary of the Treasury said with an air of apprehension and a thread-like feeling across his throat, "It boils down to no money, Mr. President." The President was too engrossed in thoughts of the marvelous collection to fly into a rage. "It's such a bargain," he said mournfully. "An archaic Henry Moore figure, really too big to finger, but I'm no culture snob, thank God. And 15 early Morrisons, and I can't begin to tell you what else." He looked hopefully at the Secretary of Public Opinion. "Mightn't I seize it for the public good or something?" The Secretary of Public Opinion shook his head. His pose was gruffly professional. "Not a chance, Mr. President. We'd never get away with it. The art lovers would scream to high heaven." "I suppose so. Why isn't there any money?" He had swiveled dangerously on the Secretary of the Treasury again. "Sir, purchases of the new Series W bond issue have lagged badly because potential buyers have been attracted to..." "Stop it, stop it, stop it. You know, I can't make head or tail of that stuff. Where's the money going?" The director of the budget said cautiously, "Mr. President, during the biennium just ending, the Department of Defense accounted for 78% of expenditures." The Secretary of Defense growled. "Now wait a moment, Felder. We were voted..." The president interrupted, raging weakly. "Oh, you rascals. My father would have known what to do with you. But don't think I can't handle it. Don't think you can hoodwink me. He punched a button ferociously. His silly face was contorted with rage, and there was a certain tension on all the faces around the cabinet table. Panels slid down abruptly in the walls, revealing grim-faced secret servicemen. Each cabinet officer was covered by at least two automatic rifles. "Take that traitor away," the president yelled. His finger pointed at the Secretary of Defense, who slumped over the table, sobbing. Two Secret Servicemen half carried him from the room. President Folsom, 24, leaned back, thrusting out his lower lip. He told the Secretary of the Treasury, "Get me the money for the Nicolaides collection. Do you understand? I don't care how you do it. Get it." He glared at the Secretary of Public Opinion. "Have you any comments?" "No, Mr. President." "All right, then," the president unbent and said plaintively. "I don't see why you can't all be more reasonable. I'm a very reasonable man. I don't see why I can't have a few pleasures along with my responsibilities. Really, I don't. And I'm sensitive. I don't like these scenes." "Very well, that's all. The cabinet meeting is adjourned." They rose and left silently in the order of their seniority. The president noticed that the panels were still down and pushed the button that raised them again and hid the granite-faced Secret Serviceman. He took out of his pocket a late Morrison fingering piece and turned it over in his hand, a smile of relaxation and bliss spreading over his face. Such amusing textural contrast, such unexpected variations on the classic sequences. The cabinet, less the Secretary of Defense, was holding a rump meeting in an untrapped corner of the White House gymnasium. "God," the Secretary of State said white-faced, "poor old Willie." The professionally gruff Secretary of Public Opinion said, "We should murder the guy. I don't care what happens." The director of the budget said dryly, "We all know what would happen. President Folsom, 25, would take office. No, we've got to keep plugging as before. Nothing short of the invincible can topple the republic." "What about a war?" the Secretary of Commerce demanded fiercely. "We've no proof that our program will work. What about a war?" State said wearily, "Not while there's a balance of power, my dear man. The Io Callisto question proved that. The Republic and the Soviet fell all over themselves trying to patch things up as soon as it seemed that there would be real shooting. Folsom 24 and His Excellency Premier Yertsinsky know at least that much." The Secretary of the Treasury said, "What would you all think of Steiner for defense?" The Director of the Budget was astonished. "Would he take it?" Treasury cleared his throat. "As a matter of fact, I've asked him to stop by right about now." He hurled a medicine ball into the budgetary gut. "Oof," said the director. "Steiner would be perfect. He runs standards like a watch." He treacherously fired the medicine ball at the Secretary of Raw Materials, who blandly caught it and slammed it back. "Here he comes," said the Secretary of Raw Materials. "Steiner, come and sweat some oleo off." Steiner ambled over, a squat man in his 50s, and said, "I don't mind if I do. Where's Willie?" State said, "The president unmasked him as a traitor. He's probably been executed by now." Steiner looked grim and grimmer yet when the Secretary of the Treasury said deadpan, "We want you to propose for the defense." "I'm happy in standards," Steiner said. "Safer, too. The man's father took an interest in science, but the man never comes around. Things are very quiet. Why don't you invite Winch from the National Art Commission? It wouldn't be much of a change for the worse for him." "No brains," the Secretary for Raw Materials said briefly. "Heads up." Steiner caught the ball and slugged it back at him. What good are brains? He asked quietly. Close the ranks, gentlemen, State said. These long shots are too hard on my arms. The ranks closed, and the cabinet told Steiner what good were brains. He ended by accepting. The moon is all republic. Mars is all Soviet. Titan is all republic. Ganymede is all Soviet. But Io and Callisto, by the Treaty of Greenwich, are half and half Republican and Soviet. Down the main street of the principal settlement on Io runs an invisible line. On one side of the line, the principal settlement is known as New Pittsburgh. On the other side, it is known as Nizhny Magnitogorsk. Into a miner's home in New Pittsburgh one day, an 8-year-old boy named Grayson staggered, bleeding from the head. His eyes were swollen, almost shut. His father lurched to his feet, knocking over a bottle. He looked stupidly at the bottle, set it upright too late to save much of the alcohol, and then stared fixedly at the boy. "See what you made me do, you little—" he growled and fetched the boy a clout on his bleeding head that sent him spinning against the wall of the hut. The boy got up slowly and silently. There seemed to be something wrong with his left arm, and glowered at his father. He said nothing. "Fighting again," the father said in a would-be fierce voice. His eyes fell under the peculiar fire in the boy's stare. "Damn fool." A woman came in from the kitchen. She was tall and thin. In a flat voice, she said to the man, "Get out of here." The man hiccuped and said, "Your brat spilled my bottle. Give me a dollar." In the same flat voice, "I have to buy food." "I said, give me a dollar." The man slapped her face. It did not change, and wrenched a small purse from the string that suspended it around her neck. The boy suddenly was a demon, flying at his father with fists and teeth. It lasted only a second or two. The father kicked him into a corner where he lay, still glaring, wordless and dry-eyed. The mother had not moved. Her husband's hand mark was still red on her face when he hulked out, clutching the money bag. Mrs. Grayson at last crouched in the corner with the 8-year-old boy. "Little Tommy," she said softly, "my little Tommy, did you cross the line again?" He was blubbering in her arms hysterically as she caressed him. At last he was able to say, "I didn't cross the line, Mom, not this time. It was in school. They said our name was really Krasinski." "God damn him," the boy shrieked. "They said his grandfather was named Krasinski, and he moved over the line and changed his name to Grayson. God, doing that to us." "Now, darling," his mother said, caressing him. "Now, darling." His trembling began to ebb. She said, "Let's get out the spools, Tommy. You mustn't fall behind in school. You owe that to me, don't you, darling?" "Yes, Mom," he said. He threw his spindly arms around her and kissed her. "Get out the spools. We'll show him. I mean them." President Folsom, 24, lay on his deathbed, feeling no pain, mostly because his personal physician had pumped him full of morphine. Dr. Barnes sat by the bed holding the presidential wrist and waiting, occasionally nodding off and recovering with a belligerent stare around the room. The 4 wire service men didn't care whether he fell asleep or not. They were worriedly discussing the nature and habits of the president's firstborn, who would shortly succeed to the highest office in the republic. "A firebrand, they tell me," the AP man said unhappily. "Firebrands, I don't mind," the UP man said. "He can send out all the inflammatory notes he wants, just as long as he isn't a fiend for exercise. I'm not as young as I once was. You boys wouldn't remember the old president, Folsom 22. He used to do point-to-point hiking. He worshipped old FDR. The INS man said, lowering his voice, then he was worshiping the wrong Roosevelt. Teddy was the athlete. Dr. Barnes started, dropped the presidential wrist, and held a mirror to the mouth for a moment. "Gentlemen," he said, "the president is dead." "Okay," the AP man said. "Let's go, boys. I'll send in the flash, UP. You go cover the College of Electors, INS. Get on to the president-elect. Trib, collect some interviews and background." The door opened abruptly. A colonel of infantry was standing there, breathing hard, with an automatic rifle at port. "Is he dead?" he asked. "Yes," the AP man said. "If you'll let me past..." "Nobody leaves the room," the colonel said grimly. "I represent General Slocum, acting president of the Republic. The College of Electors is acting now to ratify." A burst of gunfire caught the colonel in the back. He spun and fell with a single hoarse cry. More gunfire sounded through the White House. A Secret Serviceman ducked his head through the door. "President's dead? You boys stay put. We'll have this thing cleaned up in an hour." He vanished. The doctor sputtered his alarm, and the newsmen ignored him with professional poise. The AP man asked, "Now, who's Slocum? Defense Command?" INS said, "I remember him. 3 stars. He headed up the Tactical Airborne Force out in Kansas 4 or 5 years ago. I think he was retired since then." A phosphorus grenade crashed through the window and exploded with a globe of yellow flame the size of a basketball. Dense clouds of phosphorus pentoxide gushed from it, and the sprinkler system switched on, drenching the room. "Come on," hacked the AP man, and they scrambled from the room and slammed the door. The doctor's coat was burning in 2 or 3 places, and he was retching feebly on the corridor floor. They tore his coat off and flung it back into the room. The UP man, swearing horribly, dug up a sizzling bit of phosphorus from the back of his hand with a penknife and collapsed, sweating. When it was out, the INS man passed him a flask, and he gurgled down half a pint of liquor. "Who flung that brick?" he asked faintly. "Nobody," the AP man said gloomily. "That's the hell of it. None of this is happening. Just the way Taft the Pretender never happened in 1903. Just the way the Pentagon Mutiny never happened in 67. 68, the UP man said faintly. "It didn't happen in 68. Not 67. The AP man smashed a fist into the palm of his hand and swore. "God damn," he said. "Someday I'd like to..." He broke off and was bitterly silent. The UP man must have been a little dislocated with shock and quite drunk to talk the way he did. "Me too," he said. "Like to tell the story. Maybe it was 67, not 68, but I'm not sure now. Can't write it down, so the details get lost, and then after a while... it didn't happen at all. Revolution to be good to deal. But it takes people to make revolution. People with eyes and ears and memories. We make things not happen, and we make people not see and not hear." He slumped back against the corridor wall, nursing his burned hand. The others were watching him, very scared. Then the AP man caught sight of the Secretary of Defense striding down the corridor, flanked by Secret Servicemen. "Mr. Steiner," he called, "what's the picture?" Steiner stopped, breathing heavily, and said, "Slocum's barricaded in the Oval Study. They don't want to smash in. He's about the only one left. There were only 50 or so. The acting president's taking charge at the study. You want to come along?" They did, and even hauled the UP man up after them. The acting president, who would be President Folsom 25 as soon as the Electoral College got around to it, had his father's face, the petulant lip, the soft jowl on a hard young body. He also had an auto rifle ready to fire from the hip. Most of the cabinet was present. When the Secretary of Defense arrived, he turned on him. Steiner, he said nastily, can you explain why there should be a rebellion against the Republic in your department? Mr. President, Steiner said, Slocum was retired on my recommendation 2 years ago. It seems to me that my responsibility ended there, and security should have taken over. The president-elect's finger left the trigger of the auto rifle, and his lips drew in a little. Quite so, he said currently, and turned to the door. Slocum, he shouted, come out of there. We can use gas if we want. The door opened unexpectedly, and a tired-looking man with three stars on each shoulder stood there, barehanded. All right, he said drearily. I was fool enough to drink something could be done about the regime. But you fat-faced imbeciles are going to go on and on, and the stutter of the auto rifle cut him off. The president-elect's knuckles were white as he clutched the piece's forearm in grip. The torrent of slugs continued to hack and plow the general's body until the magazine was empty. Burn that, he said curtly, turning his back on it. Dr. Barnes, come here. I want to know about my father's passing. The doctor, hoarse and red-eyed from the whiff of phosphorus smoke, spoke with him. The UP man had sagged drunkenly into a chair, but the other newsman noted that Dr. Barnes glanced at them as he spoke in a confidential murmur. Thank you, doctor, the president-elect said at last, decisively. He gestured to a Secret Serviceman. Take those traitors away. They went, numbly. The Secretary of State cleared his throat. Mr. President, he said, I take this opportunity to submit the resignations of myself and fellow cabinet members according to custom. That's all right, the president-elect said. You may as well stay on. I intend to run things myself anyway. He hefted the auto rifle. You, he said to the Secretary of Public Opinion, you have some work to do. Have the memory of my father's artistic preoccupations obliterated as soon as possible. I wish the Republic to assume a warlike posture. Yes, what is it? A trembling messenger said, Mr. President, I have the honor to inform you that the College of Electors has elected you President of the Republic unanimously. Cadet fourth classman Thomas Grayson lay on his bunk and sobbed in an agony of loneliness. The letter from his mother was crumpled in his hand. Prouder than words can tell of your appointment to the academy, darling. I hardly knew my grandfather, but I know that you will serve as brilliant as he did, to the eternal credit of the Republic. You must be brave and strong for my sake. He would have given everything he had or ever could hope to have to be back with her and away from the bullying, sneering fellow cadets of the corps. He kissed the letter and then hastily shoved it under his mattress as he heard footsteps. He popped to a brace, but it was only his roommate, Ferguson. Ferguson was from Earth and rejoiced in the lighter lunar gravity, which was punishment to Grayson's Io-bred muscles. Rest, mister, Ferguson grinned. Thought it was night inspection. Any minute now. They're down the hall. Let me tighten your bunk or you'll be in trouble. Tightening the bunk, he pulled out the letter and said calfishly, Aha! Who is she? And opened it. When the cadet officers reached the room, they found Ferguson on the floor being strangled black in the face by spidery little Grayson. It took all three of them to pull him off. Ferguson went to the infirmary and Grayson went to the commandant's office. The commandant glared at the cadet from under the most spectacular pair of eyebrows in the service. Cadet Grayson, he said, explain what occurred. Sir, Cadet Ferguson began to read a letter from my mother without my permission. That is not accepted by the corps as ground for mayhem. Do you have anything further to say? Sir, I lost my temper. All I thought of was that it was an act of disrespect to my mother and somehow to the corps and the Republic, too, that Cadet Ferguson was dishonoring the corps. bourgeois, the commandment thought, a snow job and a crude one. He studied the youngster. He had never seen such a brace from an IO-bred fourth classman. It must be torture to muscles not yet toughened up to even lunar gravity. 5 minutes more and the boy would have to give way and serve him right for showing off. He studied Grayson's folder. It was too early to tell about academic work, but the fourth classman was a bear, or a fool, for extra duty. He had gone out for half a dozen teams and applied for membership in the exacting math club and writing club. The commandant glanced up. Grayson was still in his extreme brace. The commandant suddenly had the queer idea that Grayson could hold it until it killed him. 100 hours of pack drill, he barked, to be completed before quarter term. Cadet Grayson, if you succeed in walking off your tours, remember that there is a tradition of fellowship in the Corps, which its members are expected to observe. Dismiss. After Grayson's steel-sharp salute and exit, the commandant dug deeper into the folder. Apparently, there was something wrong with the boy's left arm, but it had been passed by the examining team that visited. Most unusual, most irregular, but nothing could be done about it now. The president, softer now in body than on his election day and infinitely more cautious, snapped. It's all very well to create an incident, but where's the money to come from? Who wants the rest of IO anyway? And what will happen if there's war? Treasury said the hoarders will supply the money, Mr. President. A system of percentage bounties for persons who report currency hoarders and then enforce purchase of a bond issue. Raw Materials said, we need that iron, Mr. President. We need it desperately. State said, all our evaluations indicate that the Soviet premier would consider nothing less than armed invasion of his continental borders as occasion for all-out war. The Consumer Goods Party in the Soviet has gained immensely during the past 5 years, and of course their armaments have suffered. Your shrewd directive to put the Republic in a warlike posture has borne fruit, Mr. President. President Folsom, 25, studied them narrowly. To him, the need for a border incident culminating in a forced purchase of Soviet IO did not seem as pressing as they thought. But they were, after all, specialists, and there was no conceivable way they could benefit from it personally. The only alternative was that they were offering their professional advice and that it would be best to heed it. Still, there was a vague, nagging something. Nonsense, he decided. The spy dossiers on his cabinet showed nothing but the usual. One had been blackmailed by an actress after an affair and railroaded her off the earth. Another had a habit of taking bribes to advance favorite sons in civil and military service. And so on. The Republic could not suffer at their hands. The Republic and the dynasty were impregnable. You simply spied on everybody, including the spies, and ordered summary executions often enough to show that you meant it and kept the public ignorant, deaf, dumb, blind, ignorant. The spy system was simplicity itself. You had only to let things get as tangled and confused as possible until nobody knew who was who. The executions were literally no problem, for guilt or innocence made no matter. And mind control, when there were 4 newspapers, 6 magazines, and 3 radio and television stations, was a job for a handful of clerks. No, the cabinet couldn't be getting away with anything. The system was unbeatable. President Folsom, 25, said, very well, have it done. Mrs. Grayson, widow of New Pittsburgh, IO, disappeared one night. It was in all the papers and on all the broadcasts. Sometime later, she was found dragging herself back across the line between Nizhny Magnitogorsk and New Pittsburgh in sorry shape. She had a terrible tale to tell about what she had suffered at the hands and so forth of the Nizhny Magnitogorshniks. A diplomatic note from the Republic to the Soviet was answered by another note, which was answered by the dispatch of the Republic's first fleet to Io, which was answered by the dispatch of the Soviet's first and fifth fleets to Io. The Republic's first fleet blew up the customary deserted target hunk, fulminating over a sneak sabotage attack, and moved in its destroyers. Battle was joined. Ensign Thomas Grayson took over the command of his destroyer when its captain was killed on his bridge. An electrified crew saw the strange, brooding youngster perform prodigies of skill and courage and responded to them. In 1 week of desultory action, the battered destroyer had accounted for 7 Soviet destroyers and a cruiser. As soon as this penetrated to the flagship, Grayson was decorated and given a flotilla. His weird magnetism extended to every officer and man aboard the 7 craft. They stuck like phantoms, cutting out cruisers and battle wagons in wild, unorthodox actions that couldn't have succeeded but did every time. Grayson was badly wounded twice, but his driving nervous energy carried him through. He was decorated again and given the battle wagon of an ailing 4 striper. Without orders, he touched down on the Soviet side of Io, led out a landing party of Marines and Blue Jackets, cut through 2 regiments of Soviet infantry, and returned to his battle wagon with prisoners, the top civil and military administrators of Soviet Io. They discussed him nervously aboard the flagship. He had a mystical quality, Admiral. His men would follow him into an atomic furnace, and I almost believe he could bring them through safely if he wanted to. The laugh was nervous. He doesn't look like much, but when he turns on the charm, watch out. He's a winner. Now, I wonder what I meant by that. I know what you mean. They turn up every so often. People who can't be stopped. People who have everything. Napoleons, Alexanders, Stalins, up from nowhere. Suleiman, Hitler, Folsom I, Genghis Khan. Well, let's get it over with. They tugged at their gold-braided jackets and signaled the honor guard. Grayson was piped aboard, received another decoration and another speech. This time, he made a speech in return. President Folsom 25, not knowing what else to do, had summoned his cabinet. Well, he rasped at the Secretary of Defense. Steiner said with a faint shrug, Mr. President, there is nothing to be done. He has the fleet. He has the broadcasting facilities. He has the people. People, snarled the president. His fingers stabbed at a button and the wall panel snapped down to show the Secret Servicemen standing in their niches. The fingers shot tremulously out at Steiner. Kill that traitor, he raved. The chief of the detail said uneasily, Mr. President, we were listening to Grayson before we came on duty. He says he's de facto president now. Kill him! Kill him! The chief went doggedly on. And we liked what we had to say about the Republic, and he said citizens of the Republic shouldn't take orders from you, and he'd relieve you. The president fell back. Grayson walked in, wearing his plain ensign's uniform and smiling faintly. Admirals and 4 stripers flanked him. The chief of the detail said, Mr. Grayson, are you taking over? The man in the ensign's uniform said gravely, Yes, and just call me Grayson, please. The titles come later. You can go now. The chief gave a pleased grin and collected his detail. The rather slight youngish man who had something wrong with one arm was in charge. Complete charge. Grayson said, Mr. Folsom, you are relieved of the presidency. Captain, take him out and... He finished with a whimsical shrug. A portly 4 striper took Folsom by one arm. Like a drugged man, the deposed president let himself be led out. Grayson looked around the table. "Who are you, gentlemen?" They felt his magnetism like the hum when you pass a power station. Steiner was the spokesman. "Grayson," he said soberly, "we were Folsom's cabinet. However, there is more that we have to tell you, alone, if you will allow it." "Very well, gentlemen." Admirals and captains backed out, looking concerned. Steiner said, "Grayson, the story goes back many years. My predecessor, William Malvern, determined to overthrow the regime, holding that it was an affront to the human spirit. There have been many such attempts. All have broken up on the rocks of espionage, terrorism, and opinion control, the three weapons which the regime holds firmly in its hands." Malvern tried another approach, then espionage versus espionage, terrorism versus terrorism, and opinion control versus opinion control. He determined to use the basic fact that certain men make history, that there are men born to be mold breakers. They are the Phillips of Macedon, the Napoleons, Stalins, and Hitlers, the Suleimans, the adventurers. Again and again they flash across history, bringing down an ancient empire, turning ordinary soldiers of the line into unkillable demons of battle, uprooting cultures, breathing new life into moribund peoples. There are common denominators among all the adventurers. Intelligence, of course. Other things are more mysterious, but are always present. They are foreigners. Napoleon the Corsican, Hitler the Austrian, Stalin the Georgian, Philip the Macedonian. Always there is an Oedipus complex. Always there is physical deficiency. Napoleon's stature, Stalin's withered arm, and yours. Always there is a minority disability, real or fancied. This is a shock to you, Grayson, but you must face it. You were manufactured. Malvern packed the cabinet with the slyest double dealers he could find, and they went to work. 86 infants were planted on the outposts of the Republic in simulated family environments. Your mother was not your mother, but one of the most brilliant actresses ever to drop out of sight on Earth. Your intelligence, hereditary, was so good that we couldn't turn you down for a lack of physical deficiency. We withered your arm with gamma radiation. I hope you will forgive us. There was no other way. Of the 86, you are the one that worked. Somehow the combination for you was minutely different from all the other combinations, genetically or environmentally, and it worked. That is all we were after. The mold has been broken. You know now what you are. Let come what chaos is to come. The dead hand of the past no longer lies on. Grayson went to the door and beckoned. Two captains came in. Steiner broke off his speech as Grayson said to them, "These men deny my godhood. Take them out and," he finished with a whimsical shrug. "Yes, your divinity," said the captains, without a trace of humor in their voices.